Good evening, everybody. We're about to begin tape number 7. This evening we're going to discuss certain traps that parents find themselves falling into when dealing with their children. Certain traps that well-meaning parents can fall into and find that because of this, their children are, I don't want to say doomed, but very often that's the case. Being a parent is all about motivating a child, getting him to want to do something. After all, when you really think about it, you understand that children can do just about anything they want. A teenager cannot be forced to do what you want him to do. It doesn't work unless he wants it to work. There's a story I know. It was told to me by a Rav in this neighborhood who was approached by a balabas of his with a problem. The son of this balabas, a 15-year-old boy, had snuck a television into the house. And he was watching this television in the privacy of his own room, but it became quite clear and obvious to the parents that it was there. And the parents tried to order the television out. The child did not comply. They physically took it and removed it. Unfortunately, there's more than one television in the world. And the next week, it was replaced. They didn't know what to do, so they went to their Rebbe, and that would be Rebbe Avram Palm Shlita. And Rav Palm told them that you cannot force a teenager to do anything. It just doesn't work. We don't have the punishments that are great enough or the force that's strong enough, generally speaking, to overpower the stubbornness of a teenager that has his mind made up. If you think about it, our children, our teenagers, could really come and go as they please. Our job is to make sure that what they please is the correct thing. Now, this doesn't collide with the concept of discipline at all. Because if a child decides that he wants to keep his curfew because otherwise he's going to be punished, then that's a conscious decision that the child made. And we convince the child to make the right decision. But if a child makes the wrong decision and he says, I am not going to keep the curfew, then there's really very little that a parent can do about it, and this is unfortunate. You can punish him and you can take away this and you can take away that. You can yell at him and scream at him. But whatever force you can muster, child can still be stubborn and say, I'm not coming home. So our job as parents, more than anything else, is to motivate the children and motivate them to do what's right. It's easier for us too. It's a machaya to have a kid that wants to come home in the proper time. And in order to motivate people, the first step is to understand what indeed makes people tick. What makes people do things, and what really is the driving force behind their actions. Now, we know that people have a lot of different motivations for doing things. Money is a motivation. Fame is a motivation. Power is a motivation. And all of these things can be used and are used in chinuch if they're channeled the proper way. But this evening we're going to talk about a different type of motivation, something that most of us aren't even aware its existence, and yet it's actually a stronger motivation than all of the above that I mentioned. And it's a type of motivation that very, very often causes parents to fall into a trap where parents actually hand over on a silver platter this Yetzirah, this motivation to the children, and once this motivation kicks in, there's trouble. And the name of the motivation is the motivation to be a success, or to be a winner, as opposed to a loser. There's a story in the Sefer Pele Yoyetz, and I've seen this also in the name of Rav Yonis and Ivashitz, where somebody calls up his Rav, and he asks him a shaila about a cow that he had just shechted. The Rav paskins that the cow is treif, and the balabas, or the shaychit, whoever he may be, is forced to throw out that cow, to discard it into the trash, and lose all the money that the cow is worth. Now, a cow is worth a lot of money. And yet, because that's the right thing to do, that's what this balabas is going to do. Problem is, and both Rabbi Yonason and the Pele Yoyetz ask a very interesting question. Let's say the cow is worth $1,000. And this balabas is willing to give up the $1,000 because the Rav says it's the right thing to do. What would happen if it wasn't a shaila about a cow, but rather it was a din Torah? And this same balabas who threw out his $1,000 cow got into a din Torah with a friend of his. The Rav paskins against him. The Rav paskin that he has to give $1,000 to his friend. Now, experience teaches us that people who lose Dinei Torah are usually not happy campers. And this balabas may curse the Rav. He may get angry at him. He may go into a tirade. What kind of ganav and a crook is this Rav, this dayan, who's making me spend this money, who's making me pay this guy the $1,000? And it happens all the time. And yet, it only happens in a din Torah situation, as opposed to when somebody just calls plain with a shaila without a din Torah. Now, why is that? Why is it that somebody would be willing to throw out his $1,000 cow if he calls the Rav with a shaila, or the Rav tells him, you know, your kitchen is treif, you got to kasher all your kalim, you got to throw out your set of china? They'll do it. I have never seen somebody get angry at a Rav because the Rav told him to throw out his set of china. Maybe he'll listen, maybe he won't listen. But I have never seen anybody get angry at a Rav who told him to throw out his china. And neither did the Pele Yoyetz, and neither did Rabbi Yonis and Ivashitz. And yet, we see daily, all the time, people get so angry at Rabbanim when they tell them to spend their money when they lose a din Torah. And that's the question that these great Gedolim ask. Their answer is as follows. We are mistaken in thinking that the reason why the person that lost the din Torah is angry is because he lost his money. That's an error on our part. If that were so, he would be just as angry if the rabbi tells him to throw out his china. The reason why he's angry is because the Rav made him into a loser, as opposed to a winner. The other person won the din Torah, quote unquote, and he lost it. He doesn't want to lose. The money has nothing to do with it. He wants to be a winner and not a loser. The Rav just made him into a loser. As opposed to when the Rav tells the person to kasher his kalim, or when the Rav tells the person to throw out the treif a cow, the guy's a winner. He's frum. He's a tzaddik. Now the truth is that when he pays the money to the person that the Rav paskins he has to pay to, he's also a tzaddik. He doesn't look at it that way. He looks at it, I lost the din Torah. And that's the point of contention that he has. That's his problem. Nobody wants to lose. Everybody wants to win. The money is not the point. The covet is not the point. The power is not the point. The respect is not the point. And the fame is not the point. What motivates people more than anything else is people want to be winners and not losers. If somebody goes struggling all their life to make $1 million, yes, the money makes them comfortable, but there is something else there also. More powerful than the comfort that the money gives them is the fact that they look at themselves now as winners. They made it. They are successful. Their friends who went to high school with them all have less money than they do. They are now winners. If somebody becomes famous, and when he walks down the street, everybody looks at him and asks him for his autograph, well, I guess the covet feels good. But more than that, what feels good to this person is he goes home at night and he says to his wife, "You know, wife, I made it in this world." Meaning, I'm a winner. I won. Nobody wants to be a loser. Winner, success, as opposed to loser or failure. These are abstract concepts, elusive phantoms that everybody defines with their own, in their own way. What could be considered a success by me could be a failure by somebody else. It's very common in the world where somebody will go over to somebody who's in chinuch, a valkishrin, a bright person, and say, "You know, with your head, you could have gone to school, you could have been a great lawyer." I don't know. I wonder how many people go over to great lawyers and say, "You know, with your head, you could have been in chinuch, you could have been a wonderful Talmud Chacham." And the truth of the matter is that it all depends upon your perspective of what's considered a success in the world. What do you consider a success? And very often, we get into a game with our children such that the child becomes motivated to win the game and not to lose. And people are willing to pay great prices not to be failures and not to be losers, but rather to be winners and successes. A simple example of this, in a very, very small level, is when a parent tells a little child, "You will eat your oatmeal." And the child says, "No, I won't." And the parent says, "Yes, you will." And the child says, "No, I won't." Now the parents and the child have just entered into a fray. They are now playing a game. If the child eats his oatmeal, he lost the game. And if the child doesn't eat the oatmeal, he won the game. By the 70th or 80th time that the child refuses to eat the oatmeal, believe me, it's not the oatmeal that he has an aversion to here. He just doesn't want to lose the game. If he eats that oatmeal on a very small level, his life isn't at stake. But if he eats that oatmeal, he is a loser, and the mother is a winner. Nobody wants to lose. That's a very small example about a kid at a breakfast table, but the truth of the matter is it applies to us. We run our lives based upon this rule of winner and loser. Like I said, people who consider themselves successful in life, what makes them happy is that they look at themselves that they won the game of life, as opposed to their friends who are losers. Nobody wants to be a loser. Now adults play games like this also. Very often we make our own games. And in order to become winners, we concoct our own rules, we fashion our own games, and we create our own players. A very simple game is the game of "look what you made me do." You see this game played between husbands and wives, between students and teachers, between parents and children, between Rabbanim and their kehillas. "Look what you made me do" is played by two players. Player number one is the victim. Player number two is the victimizer. If I want to play this game, Let's say I'll be in my study and I'll be working on some very delicate project. Maybe I'll be fixing my watch with one of these little screwdrivers, okay? And I tell my kids, "Don't disturb me because I'm busy," okay? All of a sudden there's a bang on a door. Bang, 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 bang. By the way, this is a purely theoretical story. It never happened, and Baruch Hashem, Yitzhak Hashem, it never will. Kid knocks on the door. Now the father's annoyed. I just told him, he thinks to himself, not to bother me. Now, instead of telling the kid, I told you not to bother me, in which case just creates a confrontation in which the father may win or lose, what the father does is the father accidentally, quote unquote, breaks that watch. And the kid comes in and the father says, look what you made me do. I told you not to come into this room, and now look what happens because of you. And now the father won the game. The game was called, look what you made me do. And like I said, husbands and wives play this all the time. Parents and children, Rabbonim and Kehillas. If a Rav is going to, let's say, object to the short mechitza in his shul, right? And next week, when they reluctantly raise the mechitza, nobody comes. Kehillah is playing a game. It's called, look what you made us do. Because of you, we don't come to shul. Look what you made me do. People go through life playing games. The reason why they go through life playing games is because, as I said, one of the main motivations that people have is to be a winner. And if you can't be a winner in the games that Hashem throws at you, the regular game of life, you concoct your own games. You become a winner in those games. And this applies to adults, not only children. But this evening's lecture is about children. It's not a Shalom Bayis shir. And so, we're going to take our game, let's say, of look what you made me do, and apply it to parent-child relationship. Where in this case, it's not the father that's playing the game, but the child that's playing the game. Let's say a child thinks that his parents are too strict. Now, I want you to know that it's very hard to say what's too strict or what's not too strict. Because my experience is that there are very strict parents and very liberal parents. And I'm not talking about major extremes. I'm not talking about neurosis. But there are very strict parents that have been successful with their kids and have been unsuccessful. There are very lenient parents that have been successful and unsuccessful. Let's say that a child thinks that a parent is too strict. And the child knows that the parent in the back of his mind knows that there is such a thing as too strict. And there's such a thing as pushing a child too far. And there's such a thing as turning a child off. You know what a child's going to do? A child's going to get turned off. A child's going to get pushed the wrong way. Not because the parent's strictness really did it, but because now the child can look the parents in the face and say, look what you made me do. Because you insisted that I come home at this time, and because you pushed me too far, you forced me to go over the edge and go the other way. It's a game. Look what you made me do. And children sometimes play that. Because if a child feels that he's being too constricted, and that he can't win the game with his parents because parents have the upper hand and they have the power and they have the force, he's going to change the rules of the game. See, the parents are playing a game, and the parents' game is called, you will do what's right. If the child does what's right, the parent won. Now, the child sees that there's really no way out of this game. But he just changes the name of the game. He changes the rules. And now, instead of you will do what's right, the child just changes the game to look what you made me do. And now the child becomes a winner. The child changed the rules of the game in order to make himself the winner. Sometimes a parent is going to fall into this trap by setting up their relationship with their children in such a way that the parent and the child end up on two different sides of an adversarial situation at the end of a tug of war. Once that happens, you're finished because you can't win. You know why certain strict parents are very successful and certain lenient parents aren't successful? I'll tell you what the secret is. The secret is that you have to be on the same side as the child. The child has to perceive himself and you on the same team. if you're on two different teams fighting with each other, you want one thing and he wants another thing, you will not win. Maybe temporarily, but in the long run, there are so many ways, and we're going to see this evening what they are, that a child is going to end up winning and you're going to end up losing. A football player will accept a tremendous amount of abusive rhetoric from his football coach. What? The coach yells there at the football team, "You bunch of spasticated, incompetent children, amateurs." And he's sitting there abusing them like this. And they're taking it from him. They always do. If a parent would dare say that to the kid, he'd run to child welfare. What's pshat? The answer is that the football coach is on the same team as those players that he's yelling at. If you are on the same team as me, I'm going to take a lot of abuse from you because I know that if I'm a winner, you're a winner. It is not possible, no matter what scenario you're going to concoct for me, that the coach should win, but the team should lose. Or the team should win and the coach should lose. That's impossible. If one wins, the other wins. If one loses, the other loses. If a parent wants to be successful, he has to set up the relationship with the child such that if the child wins, the parent wins. If the child loses, the parent loses. When parents tell children, "No, you will not be the way you want to be. You will be the way I want you to be." Well, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. If the child ends up the way he wants to be, he wins and the parents lose. If he ends up the way the parents want to be, the parents win and the child loses. That's a no-win situation. There are certain parents that have relationship with their children such that, child, if you grow up to be a big Talmud Chacham and a Ben Torah, we all win. You win, we win. Let me do this with you. It's an attitude that certain parents have towards their children. We all win. I am not on a different side than you. We are on your side. We win. And you win if you're successful. If you can communicate that to your child, you've gained a great deal. Again, if you can convince your child, if you can make him feel that you are on the same team as he is, and that a win for him means a win for you, a loss for him means a loss for you, he'll take anything that you say. You could be strict, you could be not strict, it won't matter. It won't matter. There are certain children that feel that way. And on the other hand, there are children that feel just the opposite. There are children that feel that their parents are always having a tug of war with them. Their parents are always, "You will do this." And if they do acquiesce to the parents' wishes, the child lost the struggle. A child that feels that by straightening out, that by doing his homework, that by becoming a Ben Torah, that by coming home on time, that by growing up to be a Talmud Chacham, he's going to lose the struggle with his parents, it's doomsday, my friends. You know what happens? I'll tell you what happens. The children change the rules of the game, and they change the name of the game. This child, very, very often, would rather mess up his life in order to be able to come to the parents and say, "Look, you lost." Not consciously, but this is what's motivating him. Parents are going to try so hard to instill within their children proper values. Isn't it a strange thing? Parents try so hard to instill within the children proper values and with love and affection, and they really, really mean it. And yet the children are so resistant and they're just running the other way. Why is that? The reason, more often than not, is that the child feels that if he accepts those values that the parents give him, the parents won and he lost. Because the parents have set up a situation, an adversarial relationship, such that it becomes children versus parents. Parents want the child to be Ben Torah, child wants not to be Ben Torah. And the parents look the child in the face, and they don't have to say it with their mouth, they say it with their eyes, they say it with their motions, they say it with their attitude. Parents say to child, "We'll see who wins this. And you know what? There are so many children out there that have won that game, that have ruined their lives, have become non-B'nai Torah, and worse, because now they're winners and not losers. They won the game with their parents. These children are unhappy, angry inside. And this is why the anger at parents motivates a kid to go just in the opposite direction. How do we understand the concept, this lahachis concept? It's not really lahachis. Lahachis means to make somebody angry. That's what the word means. It comes from kas. If I want to make you angry, I'll do something that makes you angry. These children are not lahachisniks. These children just want to be winners. And their parents, in their mind, the children's mind, they're playing a game where, if they do change, if they do improve, they just lost and their parents won. And nobody wants to be a loser. I remember I was sitting once as a teacher behind the desk, and it was between periods. And it was 12th grade girls were in the classroom and they were eating their lunch. Most of them were outside the class. And in the back of the room was a group of, I don't know, 3-4 girls, and one of the girls ate without a bracha. And one other girl asks the girl that ate without a bracha, "Why don't you make a bracha?" And she says, "I don't want to give my parents the satisfaction." Isn't that stupid? It's very stupid. And this child was misdiagnosed as a lahachisnik. He's not a lahachisnik. Trying to make her parents angry. Parents aren't even aware of this episode. What she's trying to do is, she's trying to win the struggle that she believes in her mind, according to her perceptions, that her parents have set up with her. In her mind, her parents sat down and said, "You will make a bracha." She said, "I will not." They said, "Yes, you will. If you don't, you're going to burn in Gehenna. We're going to take away your privileges. And you're not going to get a shidduch." And in her mind, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see who's right and who wins this. She won the struggle with her parents. Yes, she won't get a shidduch. She will go to Gehenna. And she will lose her privileges. But you know what? She won and her parents lost. Now, this may seem, correctly so, as an irrational, unreasonable, self-destructive attitude. And it is. But it's also reality. And it's not limited to teenagers. Adults play games too. And like I said, there are adults that will go their whole lives throwing away all their opportunities to learn, to go to shiurim, to spend time with their children, just so that they can become what they perceive in their own mind as, quote-unquote, a success, to make it in this world. Now, there are certain people that are really motivated by that. And children are really no different. It's just that they play different games than we do. And they play by different rules. Nobody wants to be a loser. And so, we have the first step in not falling into this trap. And the first step is making sure that our discipline and our instruction and our guidance to our children is not perceived as an adversarial relationship. And you're going to ask me, "Well, how in the world do I do this?" And the answer is very simple. Ask any salesman out there, ask anybody that ever sold anything, that ever wanted to convince anybody of anything, ask a politician who's trying to convince people to believe in his cause. Persuading somebody to do something means transferring your feeling to him. I have a rule that you can't convince anybody of anything by proving it to them. Unfortunately, it's so. You can show somebody on paper that this product is the best for him, but that doesn't mean he's going to buy it. What will sell him the product? If you can transfer your fiery dedication to the product to him. And the way to do that is to believe in it. Ask any salesman, you gotta believe in your product. If a guy comes to your house selling encyclopedias, and he doesn't read those encyclopedias, and he doesn't care about them, the chances are very slim that he's going to be a good salesman. If somebody comes to the door, and he really believes in his product, it somehow gets through to you. And the Gemara says this, Devarim hayoytzim min halev nechnosim el halev. That's what it means. If you want to convince somebody of something, you have to believe in your product. And so, if you want your children to perceive your relationship with them as non-adversarial one, then step one, it has to be so. It has to be so, meaning, you ask yourself a question. You ask yourself, when I tell my child to do something, did we now enter into a tug of war? Did I now throw the glove down in front of his face so that if he does listen to me, I won? I came out on top. And we have to be honest with ourselves. Very often, we need to come out on top for our own self-esteem. We need to be able to say to ourselves, I won't be pushed around by this kid. This is my house. Nobody's going to tell me what the rules in my house should be. We have to face facts. This does happen. We feel that our territory is encroached upon by children that break the rules. We become territorial and possessive, and we become protective of what we perceive as a threat by our children. Once we perceive our children as a threat to us, to our territory, we lost the game. Because if we perceive them as a threat, then we are automatically on two different sides. The football coach never perceives his team as a threat. They never threaten him, even if they're going to lose. Even if they never listen to him, they're not a threat to him. And if he has such a neurosis that if they don't do the plays that he instructs them to do, he's going to think that they're a threat to his position, he's in the wrong job. And yet parents are like that all the time. We consider our children threats. We say, hey, if this child doesn't listen to me, that means I'm not much of a parent, I'm not much of a man, I'm not much of a homeowner, I'm not much of a king of this house. And so in order for me to feel good about myself as king of my castle, I put my foot down right on top of my child's face. And once that happens, if that's what's motivating us, then we lost. Because they will change the rules of the game. The rule will not be, well, the game will not be called King of the Castle, which is what the parent is playing. Parent says, this is my house, and you're not going to tell me how to run my house. Parents is playing a game, it's called King of the Castle. I'm King of the Castle. You listen to me, I win. You don't listen to me, I lose, because I'm not King of the Castle anymore. No child's going to say? No, we're not playing King of the Castle. We're playing abusive parent. We're playing look what you made me do. We're playing you forced me off the derech. We're playing you think you're so smart? That's another game children play. It's called you think you're so smart? If you're so smart like you said you were, Tati and Mommy, how come I'm so messed up? You had me since the day I was born. You're wiser, and you kept telling me all my life that you're wiser and older than me. You messed me up. Look, if you're so smart, how come I'm such a mess? Who wins that game? Parent that feels threatened by a child may say, no, I'm older than you, I'm wiser than you, I'm smarter than you. And the child's going to say, really? Let's see how smart you really are. Let's see what a great parent you really are. You claim to be a great parent. You claim to know all the answers. I'm going to show you that you don't. And a child will be motivated then to really mess up his life, be able to win that game that was so important in his home. So, if we ever, what we have to do is, we have to really analyze our own feelings. And our children don't act the way we would like them to act, and they don't do what we would like them to do. What do we feel? We feel threatened? Is my manhood at stake? Is your parenthood? Is you being king of the castle at stake? Do you feel that your territory is being invaded? If that's so, then change that attitude quickly. Change it to the following attitude. You're my quarterback, you kid. You're not doing this, we're going to lose. Listen to me. This is not what we're supposed to be doing over here. We are not going to win this game if we play like this. I'm not threatened, but we're going to lose. It's not me as opposed to you. You're not threatening me. But look, get yourself together. We got to win over here. Let's get out there and win. And if you don't do it the right way, I'm going to kill you. If a child understands that that's the message you're giving him, then that last line, I'm going to kill you, is okay by him. There are certain parents that are so strict, and the children accept it as loving. That's what it means. Toichocho bi'ahava. To give toichocho, to give reproof with love. This is one of the simplest yet most true interpretations of that concept. You and me, we're in the same boat. That's the attitude. And the words won't help. If you tell your kid, you go home tonight from the shir, and you say, okay, Rabbi Shapiro, he put these words in my mouth. And you go to your kid, and you say, okay, now I got him under my control. Kid, you and me, we're all both on the same boat. You are my player. If you don't do this, we're not going to win. Let's win. Let's do this. It's not going to work. It has to be so. Dvarim hayotzim min halev nichnasim el halev. If you want to sell something to your child, you got to believe in your product. You got to believe in his ability to be successful. You got to believe that you two are on the same team. If you believe that you're both on the same team, then it's going to be so. Children pick up from their parents' actions, from their twitches, from the way they move their eyes, from their attitudes. Children are so good at smelling out what their parents' real attitudes are. Parents can buy the children the greatest presents in the world. But if inside that's just a cover-up for an underlying, deep-seated hostility or animosity, the child will pick that up. If we want the children to believe that we're on their side, it has to be so. And it's not an easy thing I'm asking from parents, because what I'm asking is that we should get rid of our own insecurities. Because a coach that's not sure about his own abilities really is not going to be a winner. And parents that are not sure of the fact that this child, no matter what happens, is still their child, and that, you know what? In Olam Haba, they're going to be connected. In Olam Hazeh, after the parent dies, this child, whether you're happy with his actions or not, is the only thing that's going to be left. He's the one that's going to be saying Kaddish for you. He's the one that's going to continue the Dairis. There is nothing left except him. This is you. We really have to understand this. I was talking to a lady, a mother of a child, and the child left home. The child left home for life on the street, and she told me a story where she and her husband were driving down 13th Avenue, and they saw their son around the car with a number of other vagrant youths, and the husband commented, look, there's the Russia. The Russia. That was his kid. That's what he said about his kid. That's what he told his wife. Oh, he didn't tell me this, she did. But I told her, I said, you know what? Next time I'm walking down 13th Avenue and I see your husband, I can go and say, look, there's the father of the Rusha. Wouldn't that be true? Parents and children are so interrelated. We have to understand that sometimes parents are in such pain that in order to block out the pain, they try to put up a wall between them and their children. They try to sever that umbilical cord that always exists even after the doctor cuts the one that he was born with. Parents try to sever that, cut that. They try to build up a wall between them and their children in order to protect themselves from the pain. And it will probably protect them from the pain to a certain extent, but it won't get them their children back. The price we pay for loving our children is pain. And it's a price that's well worth it. Once we try to dull that pain or to numb it, we are hurting our relationship with our children. You can try to eliminate it by repairing your relationship with the child. You can try to terminate it by restructuring the family dynamics. You can try to do away with the pain by fixing the problem. But once you give yourself a shot of Novocaine and become numb to the pain, once you try to put up a wall between you and your child, then you've lost because you're no longer on the same team. Friends, teammates feel each other's pain. They don't block it out. They don't numb it. If that's what's happening to us, then we're not on the same team. So this is trap number one for this evening. A parent can discipline a child. A parent can guide and direct a child. A parent can set rules for a child. And even, yes, order a child. But it depends on the attitude. Are you and the child on the same team? If you win, he wins. If he wins, you win. And if this child loses, you're a loser. If you both are on the same team, he's going to take it. Once you sever that, he won't. It all boils down to one thing. You got to believe that it's so. If you believe it. Moshe said that long ago in the United States of America, I guess we're talking, what is it now, 1990s, I guess we're talking about 50 years ago, there were many Jews who came to America and were Meiser Nefesh to keep Yomkeit. You know how the motto was in those days. You work 6 days a week and then the seventh day you get fired. That's the way it was. And there are people that really went through fire in order to keep Torah and mitzvahs. And yet their children all went off to move to Long Island and became fry. Why did this happen? If the parents were so dedicated to Frumkeit, what went wrong in their relationship with their children? Why couldn't they impart that inheritance to them? And Rav Moshe said, because these people always used to do a terrible thing. They would come home, and they would espouse the motto that was going around in those days. It's Yiddish, and it goes like this. Es ist schwer zu sein Jid. It's hard to be a Jew. It's hard to be a Jew. So why in the world would the kids want it? No. Rav Moshe said this. He said, this was the problem. It's not hard to be a Jew. It's hard not to be a Jew. It's hard to be a guy. It's not hard to be from. It's hard not to be from. It's hard to live a meaningless, purposeless, structureless, directionless life. It's hard to know that, to live a life knowing that you have nothing to look forward to except the grave. It's hard to live like that. To be a Jew and know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always watching over you. And yes, even if you get fired, it's all Gamzu L'Toiva. And Hashem will take care of you. And if it's painful in this world, we live in this world what? Yemei Shnei Seinu Bahem Shivim Shanavim B'Gvuroi Shmoinim Shana, 70, 80, 90 years. And then for millions and millions and millions of years. And then long after that, we're going to be reaping the rich reward that we deserve. So which life is easier and which life is harder? The Shvetze Zayna Yid, said Reb Moshe, destroyed a large chunk of a generation. If we want to give over the importance of Frumkeit to our children, we have to not only believe in the product that we sell, but we have to love the product that we sell. And I'll tell you, there was a vart that was, I saw, it was, it belongs to a balabas in my shul, a man by the name of Reb Eitan Kovri, who wrote a sefer called Nechmas Leah, and in there he says the following pshat. In Birkas HaTorah we say in the morning, V'ha'arev no Hashem Elokeinu es divrei sayroscho, v'finu v'fiyo yisamcha beit Yisrael, that Hashem, you should make the Torah sweet to us and to all Jews. And then it says, V'niya tzatzainu v'tzatzai tzatzainu, that our children, our children's children, should be learned dei sarasecha, that they should learn your Torah and work in your Torah lishmo. What does one thing have to do with the other? So now we know what one thing has to do with the other. The only way that our children and children's children are going to grow up to be B'nai Torah, the only way is going to be tzatzainu v'tzatzai tzatzainu, learn dei sarasecha. It's only if it's v'harevno. Only if the Torah is sweet to us. Once the Torah is sweet to us, then our children will accept it. That's what Birkas HaTorah is saying. It's an excellent pshat. And the nucleus of it is what Reb Moshe said. If you want your daughter to want to marry a younger man who's sitting and learning in Kollel, don't ever complain that your husband came home late from a shir. Don't ever let your children hear that life is hard because you are doing those things that you want her to do one day. Don't ever let them hear you complain. If you want your child to go into chinuch, and I know this is not an easy request, don't ever let your children hear you complain about your boss, your principal. Don't ever let him hear you complain about how tough it is, how you can't pay your bills because you're in chinuch. Don't ever let him hear how hard life is for you because you did what's right. And I'm not saying that when you complain, don't do it in front of the kids, although that's better than doing it in front of the kids. I'm saying that we have to take stock of our own attitude and not complain. You can tell your children to be whatever you want them to be. If they think that they're going to end up unhappy or having a life that's schwer, you are pushing them the other way. This applies to all of us, whether we're in chinuch or whether we're working or whatever we're doing. Torah has to be sweet to us. Our children have to see that we really, really enjoy it. When your husband says a Dvar Torah by the table, does he say a Dvar Torah where he opens up the sefer because he knows he has to say a Dvar Torah by the table because that's what his Rav told him in shul? And he opens up the sefer and he finds a Dvar Torah, he says it, fine, Yoytze Given, okay, now where's the cholent? Oh no, or does the child feel that the father has a geschmack in it? The father really, really is enjoying this. And if a father is a real father, if he enjoys something, he'd want to share it with his kids. The kids will pick it up. It's a very dangerous trap that many Erlicha parents fall into. They feel they're being Moser Nefesh, that they are sacrificing for Torah. And if you look at the bank book, they are sacrificing for Torah. But the bottom line is that it's well worth it, and that has to be our attitude. Well, it doesn't have to. But if we want our children to sacrifice for Torah, that's the attitude that we have to have. And this is not me saying this. This is what Reb Moshe said. to explain an entire generation of people, or a large chunk of a generation of people, that despite the fact that their parents did sacrifice for Torah, they wouldn't have a part of it. Because it's shver, it's a zaynayid. So, do your children think that you believe Sishver Tzazaynayid? Do your children think that you believe Sizgishmak Tzazaynayid? Do your children see when you wake up in the morning for Minyan and you go to Shul, you go with a smile on your face? You go with enthusiasm? Or do you go because Nebuch you have to? I guess going because Nebuch you have to is better than not going, but I'm not sure about that either. I'm not sure which is the lesser of the two evils, but two evils they indeed are. When we do our mitzvahs, when we learn our Torah, it has to be with a smile. Now, this is not at all a stira, a contradiction to the yira and the pachad and ashrayotam afachad tamid, and a Jew has to always be in awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not a contradiction at all. Children can feel their parents' attitude towards Torah. We're not talking about pachad and ahava. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about geshmak or shver. Talking about a burden or not a burden. And no philosophy in the world is going to tell you that you should look at Torah as a burden. Torah is a privilege. And if we have that our attitude, that will be imparted to our children. And so, we have this evening to sum up two great hazards that Erlich parents can get into. Two traps that they fall into. Trap number one is the game, being on different sides than your child, and once you're on different sides, you will not win. And two, when you sacrifice for Torah, letting your children know that what you're doing is shver. It's not shver. And now, at this point in time, we're going to take questions from the audience. And the custom here is that when the women ask questions, we write it on a piece of paper and hand it up. If there are no questions, we can end right now. Okay? Have a good night, ladies. Thank you for coming, and I hope to see you again.